Welcome to the Bajoran Palace of Music, where we have all styles for you, the visitor, to check out here. While the Federation takes all over the base here, you can check out all styles of jazz, rock and roll, techno, hip-hop, Bajoran pop. It's all here. Enjoy.
It is time for Making Tricks with Mark Chu Sub Kapla.
And of course, your other host, Adam O'Brien and James Semple. Let's get into it. G'day, folks. How you going? Adam O'Brien here. For, of course, Making Treks, a Star Trek fan podcast, brought to you by, of course, Phantom Podcast Network, and we're chiming in from Australia, from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast. And we're about to be joined by my two co-hosts, James Semple, and, of course, Mark Chu Sub. That's, of course, Mark Newbold, as we found out his Klingon name. So we're going to be tuning in with those guys very, very soon. And, of course, this is a Deep Space Nine episode, in particular, looking at the one, the only Cardassians, and what they brought to this amazing franchise, The Final Frontier. So I hope you've enjoyed the last couple of episodes. This is episode number 6. As we lead into very, very fun chat, and of course this is a series that is Mark, in particular, his favourite. So, and it is one of mine as well. I really enjoyed this series, particularly because we get my favourite starship, and that is, of course, The Defiant. That's right. The Defiant. All right, before we go any further, well, let's be joined by, of course, our dear pals from across the pond in the UK. Here we are, the one, the only, the two amazing co-hosts here for the one, the only show, Making Treks. All right, welcome to Making Treks, a Star Trek fan podcast brought to you by, of course, Phantom Podcast Network. Tuning in Australia's myself, co-host Adam O'Brien, coming to you live from Quinlan's Cantina, and coming to us live across the pond, it's a little pond, all the way over there in the UK, is two amazing gentlemen joining us to co-host as well, is of course, the amazing, and let's just say, one of the most versatile musicians and composers you're ever going to find when it comes to creating not only a soundtrack, but some rockin' tunes, because he loves a Telecaster and a Strat, we know that. That is, of course, the one, James Semple. Buddy, how are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. I could never stop laughing after you introduced me, but yeah, no, really, really good. Really glad to be here. It's going to be good fun today, yeah.
Awesome. And, of course, joining us from the brights, of course, of Birmingham himself, the StarTrek.com writer, Fantha Tracker, and all-around cool dude, and a fair hand at a bass guitar, and one amazing Iron Maiden fan, the one, the only Mark Newbold. Buddy, how are you?
I'm good. The reason I come here is the introductions are so good. I'm going to say, you could do half an hour of introductions as far as I'm concerned. This is all great.
So, fellas, it's been a week since we've chatted Klingons, and we have had a little bit of feedback from people, whether it's been on Twitter or through to the Phantom Podcast Network's social pages. And the one thing is, they love Klingons. And the fact that we have Klingon names for Mark Newbold, that was one that really went down well.
That I will answer to nothing else now. I'm just being diva about it.
And, of course, James, it was great to chat about, obviously, some of the scoring that, obviously, James Horner took on and really, I think, gave a life to the Klingons outside of the first couple of theatricals.
Yeah, absolutely. And they've always got this identifiable theme, which really helped, you know, solidify them when they moved from the original TV show into the movies. That theme straight away really helped identify this new version of the Klingons that we all know and love these days.
Oh, without a doubt. And tonight, guys, we're going to be chatting about, of course, something that's got a lot of Klingons in it and even has the quintessential Star Trek Next Generation Klingon, and he's not a very merry man, put it that way. As, of course, Deep Space Nine. We're going to be chatting Worf tonight and, of course, lots of Cardassians. So here's where you can find this show and many others like it. Go to fpnet.podbean.com for the Fandom Podcast Network master feed. You can find Making Treks, a Star Trek fan podcast, on there, as well as Lethal Mullet Podcast, and of course the brand new one I'm on, The Mullet Guild, celebrating the Dune saga as we lead into December 18, and of course Denis Villeneuve's amazing part one of the Dune saga. We'll catch you out there at the final frontier.
Captain,
you gotta get down to the bridge now!
Right, Scotty, it's time to go to the captain's lounge. Hey.
First question, James, when is the first time you came across Deep Space Nine and what did you think of it?
God damn, I can't remember at all. So I do remember, like, we bought the initial series as it came out, probably on VHS or DVD at the time, probably VHS, yeah. So we bought those as they came out pretty soon, straight after it was released. And I was a big fan, I have to say. I liked the premise, I liked the start, I liked the fact it didn't feel like it was just trying to copy, you know, what had already gone before. So, yeah, and, you know, good characters, and it's always nice to start off with something like a bit of mystery. You know, we don't know who Odo is, where he came from. I actually think the first episode's a really strong episode as well. The whole idea of linear time, that's a really high concept to get into a pilot episode. So, yeah, really, really good start. And of course, from the first moment, starting off with, you know, Wolf 359, brilliant start, because that's going to pull everyone in, right? So, yeah, no, absolutely, great show, yeah.
It's huge. Now, Mark, obviously, this is your favorite of all the series. You've said it many times. What is it that keeps drawing you back to it?
Wow. It is my favorite. And even though I adore Next Generation and the characters of Next Gen are what constantly pull me back, I think DS9 as a whole entity trumps pretty much every other Star Trek. What pulls me back? I don't know. I love the fact that these are very disparate characters that clearly would never choose to be together as friends. You know, the Next Gen crew, you think if they were in a room of 1,000 people, those 7 would gravitate together. The DS9 crowd would be in every furthest corner of the room because they wouldn't naturally come together. But circumstances and shared experiences and growing respect over the 7 seasons kind of meant that they were almost the most unified, but everybody could kind of stand up on their own 2 feet. You know, everybody in DS9 as a character, as an individual character, you could imagine they being in charge of other stuff. They could all cope and develop. And he did. He saw them all develop, you know, for very different reasons. The Quark at the start of season 1 and the Quark at the end of season 7, even though on the face of it he's basically exactly the same, he's not. You know, you've watched him go through a lot of stuff. And you could say that for every main character, but also every... sort of DS9 is unique in that the supporting characters became as important as the lead cast members, and a lot of it was serendipity and accident because the actors were right and the mix was right. But you know, across the board, everybody grew. So I think that's probably what it is about DS9. Plus, you've got that Dominion War storyline, which was just supreme.
Yeah, what's great about it is too, it's the first of the shows that's set on a space station, obviously near the Bajoran wormhole. And one of the great things about that is really it's a meeting place for so many people. So it's almost like an old Western where you have, you know, Dodge City and everyone's got to ride into a town and they solve a problem or have to go out from there. So a lot of, I think, Star Trek fans going into Deep Space Nine were kind of like, oh, we're not going to have the adventures anymore, guys. We're not going to go out with Kirk and Spock and all these guys and Picard's out there with the Enterprise D, blah, blah, blah. But I think one of the things is we got to see more people, actually. We got not only diverse characters, diverse ship range, too. The Federation plus Bajoran plus Cardassian, and eventually lots and lots of Klingons, James, don't you reckon?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they always, there's a kind of an old phrase around scriptwriters that there's only really 2 stories at all, which is, you know, boy meets girl and stranger comes to town. And if that's the case, then arguably we're the stranger when we're in Next Generation, because it's generally about them meeting other civilizations. But, you know, we're the town with Deep Space Nine. And as you say, there's, you know, new strangers come every week. Mm-hmm. And it was a really, really good collection of that. And of course, it also, you know, I don't know whether this is an elephant in the room, but, you know, one of the big things that had caused a lot of issues around script writing was Roddenberry's vision of the future. And of course, this kind of nicely sort of kept to the spirit of that while sort of sidestepping it, that as you got out on the frontier, the Federation had to be a little bit more loose about this. And at the same time, a lot of the people working there hadn't really bought into the Federation's ideals yet. So that allowed them to have the conflict without kind of spoiling, you know, Roddenberry's utopian future. So absolutely. And I think it's a great show in that sense. And then obviously as they move on, I think they, you could argue to kind of retool the series, but I think at the same time, I think the point is they said what they needed to say in the first three seasons that got that frontier town. And then I'm sure we'll talk about this a bit later, but yeah, it allowed them to have such a strong established setting that they could then move on to the Dominion War. So yeah, really great, really, really great show in that sense.
It, Mark, it's pretty shocking to, I suppose, for most fans to jumping, obviously, from going out in the frontier and doing all the, you know, the searching for different life forms, different planets, and the scientific focus of Star Trek. This is, I suppose, the first in conflict storyline, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's a good point that James makes in the sense of, because you've got a location to have the conflict. I mean, the Bajoran wormhole was an area of conflict. The demilitarized zone with the Cardassians was an area of conflict. Next Gen had seeded it in The Wounded with, when you first met the Cardassians with Captain Maxwell, all of that storyline in season four. So you kind of knew about it. They brought Ensign Roe into season five, so you knew who the Bajorans were. Right at the end of season seven, they were still crossing over with stuff into Next Gen. So they'd really set up the area and they'd set up the scenario. And then, of course, you could say that the wormhole leads into the Gamma Quadrant, similar to Voyager being thrown to the Delta Quadrant. So you kind of got all these different elements and different parts of, you know, parts of the galaxy that you're sort of exploring and seeing and such. But having it, like you say, having it as the location, it's like basically like Galaxy's Edge, Batuu, isn't it? Everybody goes to Batuu to do this, that, and the other. In Star Trek, in this part of the Star Trek universe, people would come to Deep Space Nine, and there's other Deep Space stations, a bit like Babylon 5, there was Babylon 4, yep, and all that sort of, you know, there's other stations. So it wasn't the only one, but at this particular point of time, it was so key as a location that it didn't matter that we weren't travelling out. And I think they felt that by season three when they brought the Defiant into it. They wanted to, you know, you got the runabouts, which was step up from your shuttles, but then you bring the Defiant in, which is, you know, a prototype, and you can go through more aggressively in through the wormhole and explore the Dominion regions of space, because that storyline just kept building. So, yeah, it was a very clever setup, very clever. And just quickly saying about Roddenberry, as James said, you know, he had his opinions. He didn't like Star Trek 2 because he thought it was too militarized. He always thought Star Trek 5 and 6 were apocryphal. So he had his view of Star Trek. And, of course, DS9 was announced just before Roddenberry passed away. He kind of had an early eye on the earliest versions of the scripts. And just to say, first time I remember DS9, my very first Trek convention, the 33rd UK Star Trek convention at the Grand Hotel in Birmingham, when they actually announced it on stage and put a video up. The logo was the old Next Gen font, and, you know, it didn't show anything, just some graphics and such, but so exciting. Still get a buzz thinking about that.
Wow, it's amazing. And the fact that, obviously, you know, the franchise itself is such a different thing, and also to have such a stern, tough, but not a captain, a commanding officer, and that is, of course, Benjamin Sisko, who came into it, and I think, you know, obviously, you know, Avery Brooks played it so on the nose, bang on perfect, but also gave it real humanity, don't you think, James?
Yeah, and I think it was just a great start from, let me say this again. I think they did a really good job because Picard, obviously, you know, the first captain that we'd had was Kirk. Picard, very much the diplomat and quite different. And I think the fact that they actually put Picard in the first one and gave, you know, these are, you know, as Mark already said, these are beloved characters, these Next Generation characters. We've got seven series of them, you know, and to give Sisko, maybe not a reasonable reason, but at least an identifiable, understandable reason as to why he didn't like Picard, and to have that conflict at the start, I think was a good, you know, to really identify themselves and stand out like that was great. But yeah, I mean, I think he's a fantastic, fantastic actor. And I think his creation of Sisko really, really was needed for that show, because you needed his presence all the time, even when he wasn't there. It's the way he ran the station, the way his interactions went, got picked up by, for instance, the way the chain of command went, and, you know, and so on. But yeah, no, great character, really, really difficult role to start off in, and just did a great job of it. Yeah.
It's great, isn't it? And Mark, obviously, you know, he's got such a great team behind him. Obviously, first off, as Akira Norris, you know, is somebody that you can trust to always back his play no matter what.
Yeah, and again, Kira and Dax and those, especially Dax, I think, because of the friendship they've got that goes back to his academy days, all firms up Ben as a character because he's a single father because of what Picard did as Locutus. So that edginess is there, which is beautifully set. Emissary is just a great pilot episode anyway. Mm. And Trek generally do very good pilot episodes for the most part. It was a difficult role because he wasn't the captain. He was a commander. The way the world is, it is today, people could look at it through different lenses and wonder why he was a commander, not a captain. I think they made him a commander because it was a station, a physical station. That was my read of it. It was just a rank thing rather than anything else. And of course, as he moves on, he's basically an admiral by the end of it, isn't he? You know, he's commando over the Federation and joint, you know, forces at the end of the war. But he's a single dad first and foremost, and it's so beautifully played in his love for Jake. And that whole developing storyline is just wonderful as a single dad and all of that with the ghost of Jennifer in the past because of what happened at Wolf. But also, yeah, like I say, Kira, he has to butt heads with Kira because she's all about what's happening with the Bajorans and Dax, obviously, you know, being his science officer, and he has to develop these relationships. And he's not it's kind of almost easy to deal with Picard because he's a diplomat, because of the way he is. He's an easier read in that sense. Whereas Sisko, and also Avery Brooks, is just off the chain. He's a jazz man, you know, so he's in real life, he's a different cat altogether. I met him very briefly, and it's lovely to meet him, but it was hard to get a read on him. But interesting, don't get me wrong, and fantastic at conventions. But yeah, it was just a brilliant team of characters. And like I said, disparate characters that all had their strengths, but seemed to work together well as a unit.
It's great, and it's really capped off well by, of course, the lone sheriff, of course, and that's Rene Auberjonois' Odo, who's kind of like, I suppose, he's the marshal, but the, you know, just the station cop, if you like. And I want to get your take on it, James. I find that he's one of the most human characters. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think one of the things that always shocks me, like, go back to Deep Space Nine, is how often he... And I need to say this in the right way, but how often he very publicly and very openly sort of admits mistakes or is vulnerable in that way. Like, things go wrong and he gets angry about it and he shows a lot of emotions that, again, type of stuff you wouldn't necessarily see from Starfleet. People have a tendency to have quite a reserved response to things. And there's a lot of times where you see him really get into direct conflict with people, but really sort of quite openly, you know, have real difficulties. And I think as a result, he becomes a very vulnerable character. And that's a, you know, very quick way to get the audience to identify with him. I also like the fact that, you know, to go back to your point about his lone sheriff thing, the idea of taking away, you know, he didn't like the idea of weapons being used. And again, it's what they're doing in a lot of ways here, I think, is taking away some of the fallbacks. I maybe want to address this for a second. One of the things in writing, obviously, and in films and stuff like that, is not just conflict, but the sense of something being at stake. And when people walk around carrying things the size of a small mobile phone that can effectively just put people to sleep straight away, you can take away a lot of potential stakes because of the fact it's like, oh, well, some guy's just going to quickly just shoot him with a phaser and that's done. So I just like the fact that he didn't like that because he didn't like necessarily whatever, the military overtones. And so it just takes that away from it. And again, it's that sense of being out in the frontier, being less protected. And if I can just quickly address one of the things you asked Mark there, I don't think there's a sense, or certainly from my point of view, that we were seeing Benjamin Sisko as a lesser character because of his rank to start off with. I think it was more a case of Star Trek had already done the flagship. And these are kind of the best of the best. And they'd already sort of touched around at, you know, the Lower Decks episode. Yeah. And I believe, unless I'm much mistaken, and Mark, I'm sure, will know this inside out, there was some of a thought of the Lower Decks characters being part of one of the next series, if not Deep Space Nine. And then, of course, Ensign Ro was potentially going to be the character who ended up becoming Kira Norris. So I think this idea of starting off with slightly lower characters was more in rank, not in who they were, was to just explore that slightly different take that they have on it, because you can't just tell the rest of the Federation, hey, by the way, it's me, so come on, you know. There's no doubt that John Luke gets special treatment as a result, and the Enterprise gets special treatment. So it was more about you know, the stakes are higher in some ways because we have got fewer resources to draw on. We have got fewer fallbacks. And obviously as well, the other thing is you do that hero's journey in the sense that you see him, as you say, go from a commander right up to basically an admiral and you know, an incredibly important character in Starfleet. So I think that side of things was absolutely fantastic. And it's just another reason to love them. I also hope we're going to talk about the Doctor.
Oh, we are. Because, you know, what the best thing about that is, there is something you just said about the lower decks, is because the friendships that come out of this. Now, well, of course, Julian Bashir, played by Alexander Siddig, one of my favorite actors from the UK, who's just nails everything he does. I mean, look at him in Kingdom of Heaven is a perfect example. Absolutely. Of who just, you know, steals every, like Orlando Bloom can try and act as well as he can. He does, you know, a yeoman job in that movie at best, but you know, every scene that he's in, he just steals. Like, he's one of those guys, and particularly when he's put next to Colm Meaney as, of course, Chief O'Brien, there's this, you know, the lower decks and upper decks friendship that comes in and basically breaks down all the doors. And I think that friendship, it's unlike anything else in any of the Star Trek franchise. And I think that friendship is, you know, over the seasons tested a number of times, but also blossoms in such ways we get some really funny episodes, don't you think, Mark?
Oh, absolutely. It's almost the Englishman, Irishman, Scotsman joke, isn't it? With O'Brien and Bashir. You know, they're so unlikely. Like at the start of it, O'Brien especially. I mean, we know he's a working class guy. In the Star Trek world, he's the blue collar working class guy. By his own admission, he's not a ranked officer. You know, he's a chief. So he's slightly out of the military in a way. And I mentioned the wounded earlier, and you know his history with the Cardassians, so that's well set. And mm-hmm. you know, his admiration for his former Captain Maxwell and all of that sort of stuff. So you kind of know he's got an angle on that scenario. And then in relation to his friendship with Bashir, who in the first couple of seasons he's like doughy-eyed about Dax, he's completely blown a schoolboy crush on Dax. You know, he's obviously a very capable doctor, but you know, he's completely green in pretty much every respect. And Brian just is tired of his just constant. And he pretty much tells him. And really early on, it's beautiful that they kind of persist with that friendship because it's not reciprocal initially in any way. Garrett can't get enough of Bashir, but, you know, O'Brien doesn't want to know. But it just builds so well to the end when you get to, you know, What We Left Behind and the final episode and that flashback scene when O'Brien picks up the little toy soldier and they have the whole little flashback sequence through all of their friendship and others. Back to what James just said, and it's a great point, actually. In addition to sort of in-universe reasons why you would have a commander on a station as opposed to anything else, it gives you that journey of you pick up Sisko at the beginning as a bit of a broken man with his son and, you know, and you saw a fair bit of him on the Saratoga as well, so you kind of knew what was going on there all the way through the 7 years. I think they crammed in more in that 7 years than any other Star Trek show did. Really did. You know, everybody develops. Kira goes from, you know, Major Kira to Colonel Kira and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, all the different changes, people's ranks change. Even Odo changes, you know, and you saw enough flashback episodes to when he was running Terra Nor under Gul Dukat. And he made questionable choices then. You kind of see why he makes the choices he does in the Sisko era of the station. So everybody gets growth, and that's across the board. And Julian obviously gets huge growth, you know. So, I, again, of all the shows, I'd love to know what happened to those guys after the end of that final episode.
What about you, James? Like, Julian is one of those characters who, obviously, I think he's a bit, you know, like straight ahead in his, especially the way Sid played the performance. But it's characters like, I think, Quark and obviously O'Brien, and even, you know, when he's probed by some of the other Federation guys that come to the actual place, like about his, you know, when he was illegally genetically enhanced and stuff like that. All those sort of things come to the fore. I mean, it made an interesting character, didn't it?
It did, and I think one of the things that's really interesting about him is that obviously there was kind of a backlash initially, and he was written deliberately to be an unlikable character. He was written to be a character that the audience wouldn't warm to on purpose. He was supposed to, you know, Mark very succinctly tied, you know, tied all that up in the sense that, yeah, he's kind of socially somewhat inept. He makes a lot of culturally insensitive comments early on that offends, you know, Kira. He's naive and, you know, kind of wide-eyed and just hesitant, you know, like, O'Brien obviously is kind of exact opposite end of the spectrum. He's kind of like, this is a day job. I'm doing my job and I'm just trying, you know. And so it was kind of well done. And it makes me wonder a little bit if, given the, well, you know, I don't want to kind of go too far down this thing, but given the sort of way that we have kind of fan reactions these days and how immediate they can be and how, you know, how public they can be in the sense of how big a kind of stage everyone gets, it makes you wonder if things like that would just get dropped because people can't go on that journey. Like, it makes him a better character in the long run because you think, oh, I didn't really like him to start off with, and he's really warm. You know, you actually have these more nuanced things. Whereas you wonder if it's like 10 seconds into the episode and people have already tweeted, I don't like this character, he's rubbish, I'm, you know, screw the show, boycott, whatever. You know, you just wonder, would we get that? Do we get better shows in the long term if we kind of let them, give them a bit of, you know, line, let them kind of run out a little bit and see where they're going with them, give them a chance to develop it? Because I think in a lot of ways, that where I'm kind of going with this whole thread is that I think in a lot of ways, as much as we really, really like Star Trek Next Generation, and I do love it, there's no doubt that it kind of has that shiny, maybe brushing over some of the darker bits. As it gets towards the end of the series, you do start to hear a bit more about the things that might have not gone quite so well. But a lot of it early on, particularly, is very much that, you know, Starfleet is nice and shiny and nothing kind of goes wrong. And with this one, you get the flawed characters. You know, his character particularly is flawed, but a lot of the others, as Mark was saying, you know, Odo's character. And I think because of the multi-series arc and everything, in many respects, you could say Deep Space Nine was really the father of modern television in the sense that this is where everything has gone to. So I think it has a massive influence in a long respect.
It's kind of, I feel, you know, obviously Babylon 5 was something that came out at the same sort of time where I think both of these franchises were experimenting with long-form storytelling, especially in the hero's journey manner. I mean, we've got Sisko following that with the prophets and stuff like that. But I think in that show, obviously, which, you know, which is something you can get into later, I suppose, and the fact that they thought that they had actually stolen from Straczynski's scripts before Deep Space Nine came out. But the idea that being that even when you got John Newcomb Sheridan, he goes through a very similar journey. I think that both of them have that, if anything, a bit like a Frank Herbert Dune-esque hero's journey, pushing your leaders and pushing
hello,
your...
I'm still...
Oh, hello. I think we were. Are we all back? Hello. Yeah, let's. I'm just going to kill my video, guys. Might be a bit too much bandwidth there. Can you hear me now, guys? Hello. All right, we're back. There we are. We're back. There we are. Yeah, it's Trump. It was Trump. Are we all there, boys? Hello.
Invasion of Australia.
Oh, yeah, it's the Australian satellites going down. Trump's taking them out. So one of the interesting things I think too is, like you're mentioning, you know, that we've got hero's journeys really stretched in a novel length sort of format with this this part of the franchise. And I think just like Babylon 5 did with John Sheridan and really pushing that sort of to its extent, you know, over five seasons. You know, and I think it's like that that got copied for later things with Ron Moore with Battlestar Galactica, don't you think, James?
That's an interesting point, actually. Yeah, I mean, Battlestar Galactica, I thought was, okay, not perfect, but an amazing reimagining of the original show. But yeah, I mean, I could see what you're saying in that. I think, again, it sort of takes it to a slightly more realistic level still. But I think, yeah, you can definitely see that thread followed through there. I think the other thing about Deep Space Nine, I guess maybe to go back to what we were saying earlier on, is you mentioned that Star Trek was very much about scientific discovery and really, you know, highly enlightened people dealing with, you know, the unknown and new things. Whereas really a lot of Deep Space Nine is about social, cultural, religion, and you know, much more sort of down-to-earth issues in many respects, really. And, you know, and also later on, just the sheer horrors of what warfare actually brings to the people involved.
Oh, very much so. As you mentioned before, Mark, the Dominion War was so paramount here, wasn't it?
It was. It was interesting. I mean, I know Trek had long wanted to do an ongoing storyline like that. And as you say, you know, you look back to the era, sort of 92, 93, 94, X-Files, Babylon 5, DS9 starting these long story arcs. And of course, DS9 now gets far more viewing on Netflix than it ever did on television. It's arguably a bigger show now than it ever was. But the Dominion storyline was wonderful because not only did it cross over into a lot of the fiction as well, but, you know, Next Gen to a degree touched on it, the movies touched on it, there was mentions of it, you know, there's a bit of cross-pollination, not so much with Voyager, obviously, because of where they were, but even they were patrolling, you know, there's Maquis involvement in Voyager because of the crew. But to bring in a monster storyline like that and sort of seed it, especially in season two, it starts to be seeded properly that there was an Odo and Quark episode, I forget the name of, where it starts to be mentioned a lot, and it just worked its way all the way through, build, was tremendous. And you wonder now, I know season three of Enterprise did the Zindi arc, but that was sort of all wrapped up and done in sort of 20 episodes. This was something else entirely because it wasn't just the war angle, like James said, you know, you've got the war angle, you've got Sisko as the emissary angle, you've got all the political machinations on Bajor, you've got the sort of ebb and flow of Galder Cap, because he wasn't just the black and white villain from the off. There was shades of grey in what he was doing in his interactions with the others as well, that the Klingons coming into it. There's so many elements, you know, Wayoon and the Founders and all that stuff. It was really intricate and brilliantly done. I don't think any show has ever gone to the levels of sort of multifaceted angles onto that final storyline that DS9's done.
What's interesting too is something actually you both have mentioned, obviously with the Cardassians themselves. I think really sound of what Deep Space Nine's all about is the grey areas of conflict. So look at Garak, for example, played by Dirty Harry's Andrew Robinson. Very good character actor. Well, let's get down to it. He just really particularly plays characters that you not only like, but also there's so much mystery around those characters that makes it interesting to see them in every scene and who they interact with. He's a Cardassian, obviously, in exile, and there's suspicions about him that he was once an agent of the Obsidian Order, the feared secret police, you know, the Gestapo almost, of the Cardassian Order. So obviously he could have had involvements in the Dominion War, but you just don't know. And I think that, don't you think, James, it makes it such a mystery about Garak himself?
Right, and absolutely. I think he kind of made a really good point early on there, which is that there's two things when you're in the audience, and I'm sorry to keep deconstructing film. when you look at Garak, there's two things. One is Garak as a character and how he interacts with everyone else and all the stuff. But then the second thing is just simply as a viewer being entertained. And as you rightly say, you know, Andrew's such a spectacular actor that he just every moment he's on screen, he's interested. So as a viewer, you tend to like him because you tend to like scenes that he's in anyway. And he didn't really, and that was almost needed because, as you rightly say, on paper, his character is actually quite unlikable because of just all of the background. But I think they do a great job. And as you rightly said, one of the ways of bringing his character out was his interactions with Odo, his interactions with Dr. Bashir as well. So spectacular character, arguably many times my favorite character on that show, to be honest, because he's just so good. And of course the ending, I'm sure there's an ending line where in the last episode where it's practically the same line that they ripped off on Lord of the Rings about fighting side by side with him. A great character. And again, another character who goes, even for a minor character, goes on quite an arc and a journey by the end of it. It's really changed by the end.
Oh, big time. We see a lot of the Ferengi in this too. I think, Mark, you made a good point. Quark is you know, a character who not only has grown through this series, but I think, you know, being an alien character, I think it's a good chance for them to really explore, in some ways, human traits through him and see human journey, because he's one of the most human characters in this, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean the thing about Trek that's beautifully done and as time goes on becomes less of a sort of an archetype, if you like. You can kind of look at the lead characters of Star, you know, the Klingons and Romulans, the Ferengi, and certain characters, even the Borg to a degree, and they're sort of extrapolated facets of different human traits of personality. And obviously, you know, with Ferengi, it's avarice and greed and sort of, you know, the chase for acquisition and all that sort of stuff, of which their society is completely based upon. But Quark is the archetypal, certainly by the time you get to Next Gen, when you, I know Ferengi first appeared in Next Generation, and kind of, you saw the fairly regular Captain Holliday and, you know, some of the very, very early, well, Armin played a Ferengi in one of the very earliest Next Gen episodes. But by the time we get to DS9, that has been developed to a degree that, you know, you can pick up and run with it. When you think about it, actually, a lot of the alien races, the Trill were first in Next Gen, the Bajorans were, the Ferengi were. So a lot of it was inherited from Next Gen in that sense. But he begins as the classic, you know, rules of acquisition, you know, he's going to follow it to the letter. And by the time he gets to the end of it, he's got this friendship that's developed with Odo. And I mean, even the end of that is wonderful, where Odo just doesn't give him the satisfaction of telling him that they were ever friends. And all the stuff they went through, he just blows him off and leaves, you know, which is perfect. He loves me, really. I could tell by the look in the back of his head, you know, the whole line. You know, just the relationships that he's had, the favours, the quiet favours that he does for people without making a big deal, when a Ferengi would usually parlay for something and he doesn't. You know, the whole thing with Moogie and wearing the clothes, which seems obvious, but, you know, that's another cultural thing. You can't knock people's cultures. You know, even Star Trek ones where they're all based on very obvious archetypes, you know, you've got to respect that. So, you know, there's all these little changes and tweaks and adjustments. You know, his goofy brother becoming the Grand Nagus, and Quark just, yeah, you know. Whereas they've been bickering all the way through. So, and the love that those characters have for each other is so obvious. You know, that little mini family with Nog, Eren, bless him, and all, you know, all those people. So it was wonderfully done. Yeah, you're right. It is. It's a window on a facet of humanity that just develops all the way through the show.
Really does. And one of the big ones, obviously, which we talked about in the last episode, was obviously the Klingon involvement. Obviously, everything from Robert O'Reilly's Garon until he's pretty much taken out in the Dominion water through discrediting, obviously, Martok, who's pretty much your one-eyed pirate. My name is Martok, you know. And obviously, him being a mentor and friend and brother to Worf through this. We also have some great episodes that they entangle with, of course, some of the original Klingons. That is, of course, Kor, Koloth, and Kang. And that is, of course, respectively, John Kalikos, William Campbell, and, of course, the amazing Michael Ansara, who's been in Babylon 5 and, of course, the original Battlestar Galactica, amongst many other shows as well. Fantastic actor. But one of the great things about that is that we really got to see the expansion of the Klingons, didn't we, James?
Well, I think, like, this happens with a lot of the races, is that they're pretty much thrown in as a one-note idea when they first turn up. You know, even going back to the first series, you know, Spock is pretty much, you know, he's, I hate to say it, but like early on, he's a pretty broad brushstrokes in terms of what defines a Vulcan. But every time, typically when they make a character into a member of the cast, you know, they define him as a character as opposed to somebody who just turns up in an episode, you definitely start to see a lot more facets to these races, and they explore and expand them, because you can't have a recurring member of cast be a one-note character like that. So obviously the Vulcans were very fleshed out by the end of the three series of Star Trek and the first couple of movies as well. Once you get the Klingons, and once Worf became a member of the cast in Star Trek Next Generation, Klingons become much more opened up, and they're not just a bunch of warlock guys. There's a lot to them. And as you say, like, this brings in a lot of, this allows for a lot more subtlety and a lot more depth in the different characters, and a lot more distinction between those characters. And again, the same thing applies to the Klingons and the Ferengi, were, you know, let's be honest, pretty broad brushstrokes in the first Next Generation episodes. And obviously Quark just brings a huge amount of depth to that role as well. So yeah, I think as you start to see a character become, you know, the whichever show it is, they suddenly say we're going to have one of these on the show, you know that you're going to get a lot more in-depth on that. And I think maybe, again, and I hate to sort of go back to the last conversation we had, but maybe that's one of the things they tried to do a bit with Discovery, is that we got a bit too friendly with the Klingons, and they wanted to try and make them, even though quite deep and complex, more alien and less able to be related to make them more scary. So I don't know, it's a thought.
That's a pretty good point, actually. When you think about that, they've I think the deconstruction of them in the terms of, you know, making them even far more alien and disturbing, the way they look, the ships, everything, and even having this sort of the ship in that one, without giving too much away to those who haven't seen it, is pretty much a tomb. Like, you know, if people die, they put them on the hood, like a hood ornament on a car. Like, it's pretty crazy. It's vampiric in some ways. So it's really trying to get back to the dread and the, I think the big thing is showing that it's a completely foreign culture to what you're used to, and to, in some ways, respect it, try and see where they're coming from, that sort of thing. Which brings us, of course, Mark, now I've got to get your thoughts on this, and yours too, James. Obviously, J. Michael Straczynski, earlier than Deep Space Nine, came up with the concept for Babylon 5, a space station in our future that would be basically a haven, a western town-like place, like Dodge City, in the wildlands, where everything would be happening. All teams of life would be going in there and causing a muckus. Great place for storytelling. But what's interesting is that he himself didn't think that Rick Berman or Michael Piller actually, you know, really got into those old scripts that he gave to Paramount to try and greenlight the show. But what was interesting is that he even says, and a quote from this direct from him himself, he says, if there's any winking and nudging going on, it's on the level of, okay, Paramount know what happened and I know what happened, but let's try to be grown up about it for now. So obviously, maybe some of those, as it's mentioned here, they even say that some of Paramount's executives probably took the Bible he gave them, so the series Bible for Babylon 5, and probably extrapolated a few things here and there. But at the end of the day, how many Star Trek writers moved over to, of course, Babylon 5? Quite a few from the original series, didn't they, Mark?
Yeah, they did. There was quite a few, and a few actors as well, obviously, Walter Koenig and folks like that. I don't know. I mean, I know Straczynski has said this. I'm sure it'll come out in more detail than he has laid out at some juncture. You know, he put those early ideas to Paramount. Paramount said they said no, and then mobilised DS9 pretty quick. But then, on the same token, you know, I don't know. It's tough. I mean, I suppose with Paramount machine behind it, Trek being huge, 25th anniversary as it was in 91, announcing DS9, Roddenberry was still around. You know, it was a monster machine nearly 30 years ago then, and the best years were yet to come, arguably, ahead of it, you know, into the 90s. And it's not like JMS didn't do pretty well with Bab 5, certainly the first sort of 3.5 seasons. I know he got shafted by TNT at the end and it all sort of went belly up, or Warner Brothers rather, and then ended up on TNT. But I don't know. It's the thought of a, you know, a space show set on a space station isn't exactly revolutionary, but there are undeniably comparisons. The thing I always think about DS9 versus Bab 5 was that for Bab 5, JMS had a plot and a storyline. I was remember reading an interview with him when he basically said it at the end of season one, him and Claudia Christian went to a get together, a meal or whatever, and he got chatting to a fan, and the fan, long story short, told him at this cocktail party the end of the show and kind of figured out where it would go. And it is kind of like Seven, Lord of the Ringsy sort of vibe anyway. And they'd figured out what the ultimate end was. Now, we know that season four finished and then he got his season five, and season five was a bit of a fudge to finish it all off. So we never got, you know, I know he filmed Objects in Motion and Objects in Light, I think, with the last two episodes. In season four, they went at the end of season five and all that sort of stuff. But it wasn't really what he planned. But the point being is that Bab 5 was more about the story plot, whereas DS9 was more of a setting that developed as it went and played off other things. So I think, you know, I think JMS would have landed it somewhere eventually. But yeah, there's no doubt there's big comparisons between the two. No doubt.
Definitely. Now, before, boys, we wrap up the show tonight, I want to get your thoughts on if they could ever, you know, go back to, obviously, Terok Nor, or go back to, you know, the time of Deep Space Nine, and maybe even go to the station in the future, or even would they go with some of these new series that they're doing? James, what would you like to see if they could go back to Deep Space Nine?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So I think personally, I'd like to see some level of development. Like, what was the outcome of the post Dominion Wars, you know, situation there? Because I think this is one thing that's difficult to address, and maybe to a certain degree it was touched on from episode to episode occasionally. But it's all very well calling for revolution. It's all very well this kind of thing. But it's like, what happens afterwards? How do they solve that afterwards? And you know, to have a much more peaceful Terek, almost. I don't like sequels that basically restart the same problem again. So it would be good to have Terek Nor as a kind of more, almost in a kind of more next generation state where Cardassians, Bajorans, people from the Gamma Quadrant Federation, you know, that's become actually kind of settled and is working. And then the new conflict comes from outside of it. It would be kind of nice to see that, hey, we did our journey and we kind of got there at the end. And it would be good to obviously pull in actors from the original series, but I'd like to see it like 100 years after the Dominion War, something like that kind of time.
Nice. And Mark, what are your thoughts? Where would you take it?
It's a good point. I mean, the What We Left Behind documentary last year did a brilliant job of sort of honouring the show and then giving us a sort of a writer's room season 8 sort of pitch, which was great fun. But of course, since then, Aaron Eisenberg has passed away and but now Bajor has passed away. So, you know, unlike Next Gen, which thankfully has still got everybody around, and hopefully we'll see the rest of those guys in Picard, DS9 hasn't. So, but of course, you know, Odo went back to the Great Link, so maybe Odo never came back, and you could easily work around certain characters not being there. So it's doable. I just kind of think if they do anything, and there is an interest and an appetite for it in the fandom, I'd like to think it would be something along the lines of Picard. Yeah, Picard has already shown us a few Next Gen characters, and apparently more are coming into season 2. But it's not a sequel to Next Generation by any measure. But then Deep Space Nine was always more about, as the show went on, like I've just compared Next Gen DS9 to Bab 5 and said Bab 5 was a story plot and DS9 was a setting. But really, over the 7 years within the Star Trek universe, there was that Dominion War storyline that ended when the war ended to a degree. But like James said, I would like to see where Bajor is now, where Cardassia is now. I think we'll probably see in Picard where the Klingon Empire is now. But Picard follows on way more from almost from the JJ movie, Romulus Destruction storyline that kind of filters into the two-part Spock episode, Unification, from season 5. There's elements of that, and of course it ties in First Contact and the Borg storylines. There's a bit of a mix with Picard. If you did a DS9 sequel, if you could ever get Avery Brooks back, and the Emissary comes back 30 years later, and Jake's in his 40s now, and, you know, everything's moved on. Kira's got, maybe Kira's the Kai now, she's Kai Kira, or whatever it would be, or Kai Nerys, or whatever. You know, and things have changed, and people are in different positions. I'd be interested to see it, but again, I would love to see the station. I love that location. They did a beautiful job at the Star Trek Experience in Vegas, you know, redoing the promenade. So it's a place to go. It was wonderful. So I'd like to see that.
The promenade looks so real. I think that's the thing. It's lived in. Unlike any other Star Trek set, I think it looked like a place you could go and, you know, spend your days. You know, it was one of those few places that really looked like it was a place. You know, it looked like Las Vegas. That's what it always looked to me.
It was the biggest standing set in Hollywood in its time, I think, for a long while. So.
It's huge. It's massive. Now, I want to thank my co-host for today to going through, obviously, one of the greatest science fiction series. I think, you know, like, let's face it, yes, it's Star Trek, but people come to this for the sci-fi itself. It's such a spectacle with great storytelling and some great characters. So, but we've got some great characters here too, and that is, of course, James Semple and Mark Newbold. James, thank you so much for being on tonight.
Always my pleasure, Adam. Let's do this again.
And Mark, awesome to have you on again, pal. And let's do it all again, team, next time.
Let's do it. And I know there's loads more to talk about DS9. I'm 100% confident we'll be talking DS9 again before this show's done.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to continue to feed your ears by inviting you to listen to our other awesome shows on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, a weekly pop culture podcast. For you movie fans, we have Couch Potato Theater, where we celebrate our favorite cult classic and guilty pleasure movies. We also have Time Warp. That's our fandom flashback show, where we like to look back on our favorite fandoms. For you NFL fans, we have the End Zone podcast. And of course, for you Alfred Hitchcock fans, please check out Good Evening. For you Star Trek and Orville fans, we also have the Union Federation podcast. And for you hard rock metal fans, we have Hair Metal, the 1980s rock metal podcast. Doctor Who fans, we've got one for you as well. We have Type 40, our Doctor Who podcast. If you're a fan of 1980s action films, please check out Lethal Mullet. And our newest show, we have a Star Wars podcast called What a Piece of Junk. You can enjoy all of these great Fandom Podcast Network shows on our master feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The FPNet can also be found on the Podbean app. The Fandom Podcast Network can also be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Please search on Facebook for Fandom Podcast Network. You can also email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. We are also on Instagram and Twitter under Fandom Podcast Network. Thank you for listening, and remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.